I say that man is entitled to his own happiness and that he must achieve it himself, but that he cannot demand that others give up their lives to make him happy, nor should he wish to sacrifice himself for the happiness of others. I hold that man should have self-esteem.
And cannot man have self-esteem if he loves his fellow man? Christ, every important moral leader in man's history, has taught us that we should love one another. Why, then, is this kind of love, in your mind, immoral?
It is immoral if it is a love placed above oneself. It is more than immoral, it's impossible. Because when you are asked to love everybody indiscriminately, that is to love people with...
If you saw Atlas, the giant who holds the world on his shoulders, if you saw that he stood, blood running down his chest, his knees buckling, his arms trembling, but still trying to hold the world aloft with the last of his strength, then the greater his effort, the heavier the world bore down upon his shoulders. What would you tell him to do? These words are from a novel written in 1957 by Ayn Rand. Atlas Shrugged, her fourth and final novel, seems to be a consistent guide to confirming or denying personal premises. Ayn Rand was a Russian-American author who carried with her the love for philosophy. In all the novels she has written, there are many concepts, lessons, and morals hidden within the story. Atlas Shrugged is by far the most extensive composition she had ever written. Ayn lived with a logical selfishness that can be only justified by reading her work. She was extremely dedicated to objectivism. Objectivism is the philosophical belief that certain things, especially moral truths and life values, are completely independent of human knowledge or even the perception of them. The book is set in a dystopian United States which is under a high amount of government control. People are motivated by labor, believing it will progress the United States into a better country. However, there are people working above the laborers, a very small percentage of the population, about 1-2%, and as Ayn would describe them, they are the motors of the world. They are creators, thinkers, people who live in such a way it has built them to the top of the chain of society. The characters Ayn creates are very dynamic, very realistic, and I actually found throughout reading the book that they were very easy to empathize with, because Ayn uses very vivid language and very descriptive language, and it's very easy to put yourself in their shoes. There are three main protagonists in this novel that are worth pointing out. The focus character is Dagny Taggart. She is a brilliant industrialist in charge of a national railroad called Taggart Transcontinental. She is a well-thought woman who is powerful and has the means to create phenomenal products that will change the world. She's affiliated through business with Reardon Steel. Hank Reardon is another focus character in the novel. He has created a material that is stronger, more durable, lasts longer, it's cleaner, better for the environment than steel itself. This is what drove him to be super successful in the United States. He is married to a woman named Lillian until he finds himself infatuated with Dagny. Francisco D'Anconia is an old friend of Dagny's and also her first love. He inherited a copper mining operation, in fact, it is the world's largest. He is considered a prodigy and he is capable of exceptional talents. Of course, there is a group of antagonists, and the antagonist characters include James Taggart, who is the president of Taggart Transcontinental. He runs it alongside Dagny, but he is one step above her. James is, I would say, the largest antagonist in the novel, and he completely depends on Dagny to run the railroad. She works a lot harder in the railroad than he does, and he still has a higher position, and because of the way that Dagny thinks and the way that her brain operates and the way that she lives her life, she really doesn't strive for the position. She's just trying to work as hard as she can on the railroad, and her position will fix itself. He is the opposite of Dagny in almost every respect, including politically, morally, ethically, in every sense of the word. Lillian Reardon is another antagonist. She's Hank Reardon's first wife. She's very unsupportive of him and tries to ruin Hank when she finds out about his affair with Dagny, which does happen later in the book. Lillian's very jealous of Dagny. She keeps trying to overrun his business. She tries to undermine him in everything that he does. She's not a good person.
There are two different ways you can read this book. You can read it as a fiction story and focus on the plot, but in 1,200 pages of a book written by a woman with a love for philosophy, there's a lot of different lessons, morals, and questions that you can pull out of the book that are, I think, that are really important. So along with morality, Anne does an exquisite job questioning our entire existence and being. She executes the question, what is man? And on page 131, line 42 reads, man's metaphysical pretensions are preposterous, a miserable bit of protoplasm full of ugly little concepts and mean little emotions, and it imagines itself important. Really, you know, that is the root of all troubles in the world. Many writing critics are actually upset and find themselves feeling offended when reading Rand's work, as she draws fine lines about what man can and cannot achieve. One critic from New York stated, calculated cruelty and an arid subhuman image of man. And he was referencing the way that Anne portrays man. She believes in the conscious, she believes in the subconscious, she thinks that they have limits, though, and she believes that we are not able to live our lives by moral standards because we don't know how to really live life. Like, there is no right or wrong. No matter how you live your life, you can't be correct about it. And because Anne's writing is a reflection of her own set of moral truths and values that she has come up with for herself, it is also a reflection of the way she lives her life, full of curiosity and the understanding that there really is no understanding. So, of course, not everyone will agree with her perspective on life, and actually so much so that critics have completely dismissed her literary work for philosophical garbage. Professors, critics, writing critics, a lot of people have criticized her work and deemed it as negative and offensive, almost. Another quote in the book that has to do with philosophy is on page 133, line 3, reads, the duty of thinkers is not to explain, but to demonstrate that nothing can be explained. On the same page, there's another quote that says, the purpose of philosophy is not to seek knowledge, but to prove that knowledge is impossible to man. So, her whole point of philosophy is to prove that there really is no explanation for our lives, why we're here, what we're doing, where we're going, where we came from, is that we'll never know. She thinks it's truly impossible to man. So, for the plot of the story, Alice Shrugged begins with a scene with a man named Eddie Willers. He is just an average railroad worker. He is walking in town at twilight and sees a homeless person, or as he calls it, a bum. This scene, I think, is very important and the perfect way to begin the story. I mean, I've read this book a handful of times, and the beginning is still one of my favorite parts. He decides he does not have room to care for people who do not work for their own lives, and beggars are not anything in his interest. He decides to give the bum a dime and tells him to get a coffee anyways. The bum is thankful, however, Eddie feels some sort of emptiness, some sort of void going through the night, witnessing the happenings of the town. The scene really defines the difference in classes and automatically sets the thoughtful setting of the book. When Dagny is introduced, she is in her office at Tagger Transcontinental. The book unveils her relationship with her brother James. And like I said, they have opposing views, and because of that, they have to live their own lives separately, but they disagree with the ways to run the business. They have a hard time seeing eye to eye on trade, on options for the business. They just have a really hard time getting along. Francisco is introduced. He still seems to have a thing for Dagny, however, Dagny sees no point in love until she has an affair with Hank Reardon. The idea of the equalization of opportunity bill for literature. So these people are less of politicians, but they do make an effort to reform, to edit, to create new ideas for the government to use and implement into society. So the Equal of Opportunity Bill for literature is, you know, their way of controlling who writes, who should write, who deserves to write, and then who deserves to read it. And it's stated on page 134, so much the better. Only those whose motive is not money-making should be allowed to write. So he's saying, basically, if you're in it for the money, if you're in it for the profit, you shouldn't be able to write literature because you're going to write what the people want to hear. instead of what people need to hear, what people should be learning about. And the control on literature is less of a selfish thing. They're not trying to necessarily control the press, but they're trying to create a better system for it. Trying to make it so that literature is more profitable to the people. The other point of the Equalization of Opportunity Bill is a social problem solution. So Mr. Eubank, who is incorporated in this conversation, talks about the behavior of people and the real essence of life, and he believes that the real essence of life is actually just suffering. And he believes that happiness is a delusion of those whose emotions are superficial. So his thoughts on the Equalization Opportunity Bill, he says he approves of it. Our culture is sunk into a bog of materialism. Men have lost all spiritual values in their pursuit of material production and technological trickery that they're too comfortable. So we will return to a nobler life if we teach them to bear privations. So we ought to place a limit upon their material greed. So the whole plot twist and the fiction part of the story comes in with a man named John Galt. The first line in the book is, who is John Galt? And that question is repeated so many times throughout the book as a rhetorical question in a response to a rhetorical question. So if someone asks you something you don't know, you would reply with like, oh, who is John Galt? And that's just telling them that you have no idea. Basically, throughout the first half of the book, John Galt is mentioned, he's hinted at, he is described as the world's finest inventor, he's smart, he's innovative, but people don't really know if he's real. And then you finally meet him halfway through the book, and he is an inventor of a specific motor that runs off of static electricity, which is the invention that, you know, the world could really use, is a clean motor. So John Galt, this is again where the fiction comes in, created his own mirage in the mountains, somewhere in the world that's, you know, not habited, like there's no people there, it's uncivilized. So he has this mirage in the mountains, so like planes will fly over it and they can't see it, it's very secret, it's his own society that he created of the top percent of the world, the creators, the thinkers, the motors. And he sort of watches the country, listens to the news, you know, reads the press, and he figures out who exactly are running the United States. And it's not in a political way, it's just in a progressive, industrial way. And he goes on and he invites Dagny, he invites, like, all the protagonists in the book to his society. And the whole point of his secret society is a strike against, you know, what they call the looters, which are either the homeless men or they talk about, you know, the people that are simply focused on labor, thinking that, you know, doing the same thing over and over again and running businesses a certain way is going to get them further and it's going to progress the country. And he disagrees with this, so he created his own society. And, you know, they're invited there, you know, Dagny and Francisco and Hank. And when they show up, they meet all the other fine inventors of the world. And they have their own houses, they have their own roads, they have an airport. And it's just a hidden little society that's a strike against the United States. The government, the policies, the people, everything about it. Dagny feels she has a purpose to find out who invented this motor, which we know is John Galt, but she spends a lot of time thinking about this motor and how it could have changed the world because, you know, she finds the abandoned one and it's not finished and the only person that can finish it is the one who started it. A major part of the plot is Hank Reardon's kind of downfall. Human behavior is naturally self-destructive, and there's proof of it everywhere. We eat food that's bad for us, and it makes us take years off our life. People still smoke cigarettes, and we know it takes years off our life. We still damage our brains on purpose. We don't wear our seatbelts sometimes, and I mean, the planet, there's so much trash in the oceans, and we're the ones that put it there, even though it's affecting us in a bad way. So human race naturally self-destructive, and Hank Gruden is kind of the symbolism for that, as he turns his extreme talent, his personality, everything about him, he turns it around on himself and actually just has a breakdown and self-destructs because he's trying to find out why. The basic question, why? And the question is, you know, why? Like, why are we here? Why am I going to work every day? Why am I going to school every day? Like, what is the point and what am I going to get out of this in the end? There are things undermining his business, and little does he know, it's actually just himself and his own thoughts. So now that the greatest, you know, the rulers, the motors of the world, the thinkers, the creators are gone, and they're in this, you know, separate society, the economic position of the country completely fails because there's no one there to run the major, like, super major important businesses there. John Galt wishes to return back to, you know, the normal world, normal society where he originally was from. And he refuses to do so until these moral codes of self-destruction, of money being the goal, are reduced, completely eliminated, and just gone. So towards, you know, the conclusion of the book, John Galt is actually sought out by the government to become the economic ruler. And the government officials are desperate. They're trying to, you know, like, recover the economy from losing its most important contributors. It's trying to recover from that downfall, and they finally see what the problem is. And John Galt is offered this position as the economic leader of the United States. Galt declines this position for his own, you know, his own moral beliefs, his own values. He declines this position as the economic leader of the United States. The government is frantic about it. That is all they need. If John Galt was in charge, you know, the world would immediately come together, and that's their whole thought process about it. And because he declines, they actually torture him, and he still declines because of his moral belief that he is his own person with total freedom to think and do whatever he chooses. Francisco and Hank Reardon and Dagny, they all go back to where Galt is being held captive, and they actually kill the guards who are holding him captive, and, you know, they save him from this institute that he's being held in. Shortly after they rescue Galt, the regime of the looters is over. They're gone. The thought process is gone, and the men and Dagny are free to return back to the world and create as freely as they choose. And the last line in this book is actually "The road is cleared," said Galt. "We are going back to the world." He raised his hand over the desolate earth. He traced in space the sign of the dollar. Like I said, I've read this book a handful of times, and every time I read it, I get something out of it. And, you know, out of the 1,200 pages, it feels like a lot more than that. It really does, because the story is huge, and depending on the way that you look at it, the story just expands in a whole nother direction. It's like, it really feels like it's a never-ending story. And so it is one of my favorite books, and the philosophy behind it all and the different perspectives thrown in there makes it an educational experience too. So it's definitely a top book for me, and I know that my dad's read it. I know that, you know, my grandma's read it, my grandfather's read it, and they've sort of passed it down to me. So that's kind of how I got into it, and I ended up loving it. And my copy of it's completely highlighted, completely underlined, and falling apart. But the most applicable lesson I learned from this book was material things truly do not matter. And, you hear that throughout your life. Like, people will tell you that, you know, these things don't matter. Like, your clothes don't matter. Money will not buy you happiness. And the book points out that money will not purchase happiness for a man who has no concept of what he wants. And so learning and reviewing about material items, if you don't know what you want, you're going to have a hard time getting it with money. Money is a tool to get you far in certain aspects of your life, and they will buy you only material things. But if you don't know what you want, you can't help yourself, and you can't get anywhere until you've kind of figured it out. Another thing, the world, the dystopian United States in this novel compares to the world, the United States that we live in now. It's, you know, a lot, everybody has a job, and all these jobs are very labor focused. I mean, I know I go to work every day, and I do the same thing every single day. You know, I wash cars or paint prep, and it's the same thing every day. And it does get frustrating sometimes, because I realize that no matter how hard I work and no matter how far I think I can get, there's always going to be more cars coming in the next day. There's no creativity for me to work with there, because it's the same exact thing. And so that's another main idea of this book, is that there are a lot of people who are just focused on labor, and they don't even try to create their own sense of creativity.